You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm here in my individual capacity entirely. Thank you so much for listening. We're continuing on our energy series and the national security issues we're facing with the rapid development of AI, battery technology, and on the horizon, of course, is quantum computing. And changes in the way that we engage in conflict, something we don't like to talk about, but is unfortunately very timely tonight as we're recording. We are presently engaged in tariff discussions with multiple nations, friend and foe. An advantage is often in the hands of any nation that controls critical minerals that we need to progress our economy and maintain military primacy or even subprimacy. But at present, despite all science showing that it is leading to climate catastrophe, we remain heavily dependent on oil, and we depend on China, Russia, and other enemies and frenemies for critical minerals. By the way, it appears to me, based on some of our guests, we may depend on Russia for uranium. But despite a nervous public response, we're at an inflection point, and for the first time in more than 40 years, we're turning to a discussion of the viability of nuclear energy as an alternative to all these other highly polluting alternatives, mining, oil, the whole thing. And what's happening on Capitol Hill right now? Well, last week, lawmakers from the House Ways and Means Committee released draft legislation that would phase out nuclear energy subsidies starting in, I think, 2031. That doesn't sound great, but it's happening. And at the same time, Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI, spent nearly $500,000 at Oklo, the nuclear lobbying company. Now, Microsoft has partnered with Constellation Energy to restart Three Mile Island's nuclear power plant, a location where there was a near meltdown in the 1970s. And to talk about where we are going with nuclear energy is someone who is unquestionably one of America's leading experts in the field of nuclear energy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Professor Karu Shirvan. He's the director of the Reactor Technology Course for Utility Executives by the National Academy of Nuclear Training, director of the accident tolerant, I don't like that word, Karush, accident tolerant, fuel integrated research project, and fuels irradiation lead at the MIT reactor. And his list of titles really goes on and on. His no-nonsense, accessible presentations and podcasts have brought education on the topic of nuclear energy to his nuclear science students and colleagues at MIT, industry experts, and frankly, to the public. We'll hyperlink to one of the videos where he is discussing the technology. I think you'll like it. Fortunately, he's agreed to join us to discuss where we are in nuclear technology and its likely role in supporting the development of AI. Thanks for coming in, Karush. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's set a baseline. Can you talk about what non-state commercial nuclear energy is powering right now, including civilian, commercial, and military functions?
Yeah, so today, the commercial industry in the United States, we have 94 reactors. They're spread out across 54 sites in 28 U.S. states. So just above half of U.S. states have a nuclear power plants. If you like a mental picture of where they are, pretty much everything is on the East Coast, a little bit central Midwest. On the West Coast, we have only a handful of reactors. And all of these reactors produce electricity. Some of this electricity does go for DoD assets, since DoD is connected to the commercial grid and nuclear provides just around 19% of the U.S. electricity. But they do not have any specific role powering DoD infrastructure.
Before we get off that topic, I'm picturing a map of the United States and pins clustered on the East Coast. What occasions the placement of these nuclear power plants on the East Coast?
In general, the coasts are popular for nuclear power plants worldwide because nuclear power plants happen to be one of the largest power plants of its type in the world. So on average, a nuclear reactor in the U.S. has more than 1,000 megawatt electric. As part of its power production system, it dumps two-thirds of the power it produces as heat to rivers, oceans, and bodies of water. And one-third of it actually becomes that 1,000 megawatt of electricity. So you're dumping 2,000 megawatt thermal. In layman terms, that's equivalent to an amount of water 5 million people use per hour. So it's a lot of heat that has to be dumped. So access to water becomes really convenient for these reactors. And overall, if you look at history of nuclear power, there's been a lot more public support on the East Coast than the West Coast historically. And we ended up basically with a lot of these reactors on the East Coast.
Does seismic stability have some role in placement on the East Coast too?
Yeah, so one of the reasons historical public support was high is that once you go to West Coast, particularly in the California region, you do have a much more seismic potential. You also start getting lots of the deserts in that area once you move a little bit to the east, where you don't have as good of access to rivers. However, we still have a couple of plants in California. These are the Diablo Canyon plants on the Southern California.
Let's talk about coal. Coal is a big, almost political topic in the United States, and there's a belief that coal regions have occasionally really decided elections in the United States. But how much is nuclear power generating versus what we're getting from coal?
Yeah, currently coal produces around 16% of U.S.'s electricity, accounts for 90% of coal generation. There's another 10% of coal that's used for industrial heat and non-electricity utilization, but by and large, it produces electricity. So it's a little bit less than nuclear today in terms of total electric production, but once you account for that non-electricity production, it's a little bit more than nuclear. So they're kind of comparable. The main difference is that they both use steam cycles to generate electricity, but the main difference is that coal tend to be more efficient. So instead of having one third of its heat generated to electricity, like nuclear, coal has 40 to 45% of its heat can be generated to electricity.
Okay. And there's no way to sort of improve the amount of electricity that is generated by nuclear. Like that is optimum.
Yeah. So we all use water-cooled reactor technology predominantly around the world. And it's the only technology in the U.S. What coal plants use is what's called supercritical water. It's basically just a state of water at higher temperatures and higher pressures. When the industry looked at this many decades ago, they found that we really need to come up with new materials, particularly for the nuclear fuel itself. And that research and development really never matured. So we're limited to run all of our water-cooled reactor in the subcritical conditions. And we can't really get to the temperatures and pressure that coal plants use using the water cool technology.
So we've talked a lot about large nuclear power plants, the water, seismic stability. Another factor in my mind is the fact that the globe is warming and sea levels are rising. I know the U.S. military has even adapted its infrastructure to accommodate that. I mean, is that a concern with respect to placement of nuclear power plants, particularly when they tend to be sometimes by the ocean?
Yeah, that's something that utilities take into account. You can imagine the nuclear power plants, particularly in Florida, have that question being asked from them. And they do make different investments in forms of building, higher walls or other, mitigation events. These power plants, especially since they're at the coast, they're designed to withstand floods. And so that's something that's definitely in the minds of utilities. And a modification to the sites like this do tend to come at a high cost. And at some point, it may be that the added cost versus continual operation of these plants may end up being a deciding factor on their life extension.
Well, we are a capitalist society, right? And they're often privately run. Okay, so do we have what we need if we really wanted to expand nuclear technology? We talked about the water, the location, but what about trained personnel and scientists?
Just like many industries, particularly in the post-COVID world, nuclear industry and community is struggling with the workforce question. We have a pretty bimodal distribution, a lot of inexperienced workers and a lot of experience hitting retirements. So that's something that requires a lot of investment, both from industry and government, to build up. In terms of building power plants, they don't need, only nuclear engineers. They need a lot of welders, pipers, electricians, and all across these skilled labor, there's shortage So even if we eliminate the Nuclear Regulatory Commission tomorrow, we're not going to be able to build many of these power plants in the U.S.
That's not a sunny outlook at all. But what is the typical lifespan of a nuclear power plant?
Just like any type of thermal power source, so coal plant, natural gas plant, to get those commodities connected to the grid, you need to have, 4 or 5 years ahead of time planning. In the nuclear side, that planning is going to be extended by additional 2 to 5 years because you also need early site permit. You need to be confident that the site that you plan to build this technology that has been certified. And then once you start building this power plants, on average, each one you need between 5,000 to 6,000 workers at peak time to build these power plants. Last time we built a power plant, it took a total of 10 years from start of pouring the first nuclear concrete to the commissioning. There was almost 10 years of pre-planning before that. So at the end of the line, once it's finished, then the power plant is licensed to operate for 40 years. Many of our existing plants have already reached that 40 years. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has extended that from 40 to 60. And now we have several plants that have gotten extension from 60 to 80. And there's already some talks about going from 80 to 100.
Okay, so that's a pretty long lifespan. And this is a heavily regulated industry. So I'm going to presume that if there's a crack somewhere or a problem, it's going to be addressed to expand the life of the facility itself.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is a very heavy regulated industry. So through routine inspections and pretty good, actually, investment on capital. If you look at the cost breakdown of existing nuclear reactors, there's about 10 to 25%, depending on the year, of investment just for refurbishment of constantly replacing the other parts. One of the reasons that we see coal plants and natural gas plants having a 30 to 40 year lifetime is that at some point you have to replace the turbines, the steam turbines, and what runs the steam cycle. And nuclear power plants also have to do these replacements. And they make this investment because the nuclear core itself and its reactor vessels and its component, that's the part that a lot of the focus is on, can we operate these for a longer and longer period. In one case, when they changed one of the main components that's inside the containment building that has all these nuclear related components, they had to actually dig a hole in this very thick containment building. And, there starts to crack. This building starts to crack. And the owner, this is in Florida, they, because there's a crack now in your containment, they had to shut down the decommission plant at multi-billion dollar loss. So it is a risky thing, but once it passes all the inspections and everything and we feel safe, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows these plants to move on until they hit a basically a non-safe point.
That's a frightening thought. By the way, they need some sort of like doggy door or something that they can activate and replace things so it doesn't crack, although maybe that's probably not legal.
Yeah, on that front, when they designed these plants, they never thought that they would operate more than 40 years or 60 years. So they didn't actually build these things with ability to remove this.
Okay. So what scares everybody about nuclear, and I'm speaking broadly for the American public, it may be different in places like France, but it's really the issue of where the waste is going to go. And I guess one of the questions that I have is, do we need to produce that much waste? What are places like France isn't, what is it, the size of a couple of states? I mean, they're managing this. I don't know how. But can't this stuff be recycled and then used again? Is there a better solution than the approach we've taken? And are members of Congress right to be afraid? If you could speak on these waste issues.
Yeah. Just like any industry, we have waste. Now, that waste is typically divided into low-level waste and high-level waste. And the high-level waste is the one that's typically publicly talked about. That is the spent fuel that we have from our reactors. The low-level waste, which accounts for roughly 97% by volume, that's taken care of using surface depth burials. There's multiple sites in the U.S. There's South Carolina, Texas, state of Washington. And that's also a lot of the other waste coming from a medical application, as well as old legacy weapons programs go in there. And now the high-level waste, which is 3% of the total waste volume, has 95% of the radioactivity. And that's the dilemma that we're always trying to address is, you know, what do we do with it? Which state takes it? Right now, what we're doing is we're taking this and putting them into dry casks. These are steel canisters shielded by a thick concrete casing, which can withstand large drops, plane crashes, train crashes, the different things. And they're sitting there on the nuclear power plant sites. Now, every country around the world, more or less the consensus is that we should bury these things in a site that has good rock and soil conditions beneath the earth. And that's what, you know, Sweden and Finland, they're basically right about ready to do this. In the US, the issue has been, where do we site them? Canada, just our neighbors in the north, just this year, they found a site where they got an agreement from the locals where they bury this. Now, can we do something else with this? In France, they take this and they actually do a once-through reprocessing. So they do one recycling and put it out. That way you can also further reduce that volume. By the way, this volume, I think you if you search on the internet, you commonly hear this comparison of if you put all the spent fuel of all the reactors in the US for their entire lifetime, you can fit them in the size of a football field. So we're talking about something that's very, very small by volume compared to other energy sources. You know, that's what France does. And so the question is, will US do the same? In fact, the current administration recently put an executive order that we should re-look at recycling, which we abandoned under President Carter's administration. The reason we don't do it and the reason the industry doesn't really put money into it is because it's too expensive. In France, both the electricity utility as well as the reprocessing site is fully state-owned. And in the US, if last time the government looked to take part into reprocessing some of the legacy weapons for use of fuel for reactors, the price tag for that plant climbed up from $5 billion all the way to upwards of $40 billion. You know, unless we see that level of support from the government, currently still economically doesn't make sense for us to reprocess. But reprocessing and reburning the fuel can really both shrink the size of the repository, but also reduce the time it takes for this radioactivity to go away over time.
Obviously, we enjoy very low energy costs in the United States compared to other countries. If that were to change, maybe there would be more public buy-in. No one would welcome that, but I think it's a real possibility in the current conflict environment. On the topic of the conflict, I'm not great at this, but I know people who are really good historians of warfare. And I mean, that's apparently a whole niche and very masculine interest. And they're telling me, and they have told me, and I've verified this, that any energy source is always targeted when you're trying to subjugate an enemy in warfare. I guess in my mind, nuclear power plants, if they were generating a lot of U.S. energy, even the amount that they are, if they could be targeted, it could certainly be a blow to the United States. What is it about the construction of these plants, if there is anything consistently that makes or protects them from that type of thing?
Yeah, when these plants that we have today in the U.S. were constructed, these issues of attacks, issues of what we saw with 9/11 wasn't really part of what they were designing for. They were designing for things like, okay, I'm building these set of reactors in California. They have to withstand, you know, these very, very conservative, you know, earthquakes. They weren't thinking about those. Once 9/11 happened, industry back then was, you know, nuclear existing reactors. They already had paid off their capital debt and they were left with operation maintenance and fuel costs and they were very profitable. And so industry took upon itself to increase the amount of guards. So now you have per site, you have over 100 armed guards and different infrastructure to shoot down any type of, let's say, attack, missiles or things that may come at you. In general, the containment buildings, they've done tests and they've seen that when you have, you know, over 3 meters of concrete can really take a lot of impact. So through those post 9/11 programs, industry, the existing plants have gotten themselves ready. Now, newer designs, they've had it now at the added requirement by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of withstanding a commercial aircraft crash. And that by itself also protects you from missiles and other sorts of attacks.
That doesn't protect you from a cyber attack. I wonder if cybersecurity is really a consideration as well for these companies. And, you know, recognizing we talk about a workforce of very young and near retirement, it's usually an employee that is the person who commits the error by clicking on a spear phishing campaign or anything. Do they address this through training? Right. It's always somebody on the inside who's like, yes, that probably is a woman who saw me at the party. I'm going to click on that. What do they do about that? Because I know that's as big a threat as a bomb.
Yeah, cybersecurity is taken very seriously. And that's been part of the nuclear power plant actually designed from the beginning. There is no network connection for a nuclear power plant to the outside world. So the only type of cyber attacks they can do is within. And from within, the way they address it is through very rigorous, you know, screening, background checks, training. So there's operator can't unknowingly do it. You only can do it knowingly if you've passed all those steps. And from that, even that point of view, now NRC has done, you know, cybersecurity exercises. So what happens if an operator is tricked or if somebody, you know, gets in there and trick the control system? And one of the features that all of our reactors in the US share is what's called an inherent physics safety. We call it reactivity. We use this term reactivity safety, in that if there is, you know, malfunction that tries to, you know, move things that tend to, you know, control the neutron population that causes this fission reaction that generates this heat, then there is inherent features like if fuel temperature goes hot, those things will shut down. And what we have to deal with is to make sure that long-term cooling is not impacted. But that part takes on the order of hours. It's not something that, you know, in a second you can quote unquote blow up this reactor.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.